From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, March 10th, 2017. And on this day, facing cuts in state funding, Maine teachers create a new kind of professional development, and New England ski resorts prepare for climate change. That's all ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
First tonight, a medical tourism project in Auburn is at a standstill. A Chinese investment company unveiled the plan to build a 5-star medical recovery center 2 years ago. But as Patty White reports, the company's waiting for approval from the federal government.
The medical tourism facility, which would cater to wealthy Chinese tourists, was originally scheduled to open this year. But Erica Dodge, spokeswoman for Central Maine Medical Center, says hospital officials have not been in touch with the Chinese company behind the project, Miracle Enterprise, for some time.
Our new CEO, Jeff Brookman, who got here about 6 months ago, has not been in contact with them.
The project was announced under former CEO Peter Chalk, who said the hospital was a partner. When he retired last summer, Dodge says it's her understanding that the ball was left in Miracle Enterprises Court, who was looking for investors.
You know, we're here and we're ready and willing to pursue partnerships in the community that help continue to serve and provide high-quality health care, but it's hard to talk about something that's very nebulous, and the details of this project are very nebulous.
Last summer, Auburn Mayor Jonathan Labonte said the city was doing what it could to create infrastructure to support the 200-room medical recovery center. Auburn city officials did not respond to requests for comment for this story, but a spokesman for the Maine Department for Economic and Community Development, Doug Ray, says the state has been in regular contact with a consultant for Miracle Enterprise, who says the company is awaiting approval of a federal application.
They're in the same boat that we're in right now, is they are in a holding pattern awaiting the approval of the EB-5 regional center so they can move forward.
Maine applied to become an EB-5 regional center more than a year ago. It would allow foreign investors to fast-track through the immigration process if they invest at least $500,000 into a project that creates at least 10 jobs. Ray says the state is expecting to hear any day. If approved, he says, the state hopes to apply the program to the medical tourism project and others. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
It's budget season for school districts across the state, and they are grappling with funding proposal from Governor Paula Page that would cut state funding by about $20 million from last year's levels. One of the ways districts have handled those cuts in the past is by slashing professional development for teachers. As Robbie Feinberg reports, teachers are now creating a new kind of professional development that's cheaper and possibly more effective.
Everybody, it's great to see everyone so early on a Saturday.
About 100 educators from across Maine pack into the auditorium of Portland's Wainfleet School on a chilly Saturday morning. They're here for a different kind of professional development event.
We're going to put the schedule up.
Alice Barr, a school technology director from Yarmouth, explains to the group that there's no actual set schedule today. Instead, the teachers will decide what they want to learn. Just shout out ideas, she tells them.
Basically, we go around the room and kind of see what people want to offer.
One wants a session on gender identity in the classroom. Another would like to learn about teacher leadership, another new technology. Their ideas are quickly compiled into a makeshift agenda that will be used to conduct sessions later in the day.
Anybody interested in Google Expeditions? Okay, so we could put that on.
At first, it all seems a bit chaotic. Everything happens on the fly here. There are no experts in the room.
You know, it's just real teachers talking about something they actually did in class, and oh yeah, I can do that too.
Paige Lenig is the technology director at Wainfleet and one of the founders of the event called EdCamp Maine. She started this conference 6 years ago based on similar national models. And she says most professional development consists of just an expert talking about a certain topic and then leaving. But by talking with each other, Lennox says, teachers can focus on very specific components of education, whether it's technology, curriculum, or something else. They can listen to each other, she says, and figure out what's working best.
And flesh out what works, what doesn't work, or maybe a better alternative. So I think the EdCamp model is really about that, like bringing those people who have done it, bringing them together, and moving forward with their ideas.
Following the chaotic morning session, about a dozen teachers meet in a nearby classroom and huddle around a few desks. The group has decided to talk about early childhood curriculum integration, basically how to connect science, math, and other subjects together for young children.
Hey, you guys, we're starting, Jackie.
It starts off a little awkwardly. No one is sure who should talk first. But soon the conversation takes off and turns to what's not working in the classrooms. Many are upset about the prescribed curriculum they're mandated to teach.
What I don't want is me to be on page 52 on Wednesday and page 75 next Thursday, and if I'm not there, get flack.
But from this exchange springs new ideas. A kindergarten teacher from Gorham explains how she and two other teachers have mixed and matched those prescribed lessons to create a brand new program that she says has seen success in certain math subjects.
And all three of us have kids soaring through the roof. So much that they might not need to know how to do addition because they already get the concept. So now we're going to.
And while teachers may be able to share lessons like this, the other advantage of EdCamp is the price tag. It's free. That's important, says Lennox, as many districts have slashed professional development in the wake of budget cuts in past years. And that trend could continue.
So teachers don't have to, you know, try to scramble for money or pay for it themselves.
But while the EdCamp model has its supporters, some question whether it's a true substitute for professional training.
I'm not sure that EdCamps can go into great depth on any of those particular issues that teachers come up with. It kind of depends on who's in the room when we do the session.
Dan Allen, the Training and Professional Development Director with the Maine Education Association, says he's not happy that budget constraints are affecting professional development for teachers. But he does see the EdCamp model as a way to provide educators with some help in adapting to changing requirements.
Do we just throw our hands up in the air and say, well, we're not going to have any professional development, and we'll just hope that someday that the state comes up with some money or the district comes up with some money and then puts it into use? Teachers who are thinking ahead are saying to themselves, it's my responsibility to get myself educated appropriately, and these ed camps are one way of doing that.
In fact, Allen says his goal with the MEA is to embed this kind of targeted teacher-driven professional development into specific school districts so teachers can share their own struggles and help each other out. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And for disclosure, the Maine Education Association represents most of the reporters at Maine Public Radio. Education reporting on Maine Public Radio is supported by a grant from the Nellie Mae Educational Foundation. It is well known among Maine art lovers that the iconic Andrew Wyeth painting, Christina's World, is a portrayal of a real woman, Christina Olson, and her real house in rural Cushing. Now Olson's the subject of the new book, A Piece of the World, by part-time Southwest Harbor resident Christina Baker Klein. Klein grew up in Bangor and visited the Olson House, now part of the Farnsworth Museum, as a child. A Piece of the World tells Olson's story. I spoke with Christina Baker Klein about the book and asked her how she did her research.
Well, Christina never had children, never married and never had children. But her brothers, except for Alvaro, the brother she lived with, did. And so I was privileged to speak with Jean Olson, Jean Brooks Olson, who is her niece, a lovely woman who wrote an incredible book, which is now out of print, essentially about her whole life story. And many of the details that she described in a sentence or two, I used as the basis for chapters. Christina's nephew, John, who by many accounts was her favorite, also wrote a book, a sort of autobiography, but a lot of it was about Christina. And probably my greatest resource was Richard Merriman's biography of Andrew Wyeth, which is masterful. I wanted to see if I could do this, even though it's a first-person narration from the perspective of the woman in the field, I wanted to see if I could do it by sticking to the facts of the story almost entirely.
When you say you you use certain details to flesh out into chapters, which details are you talking about? Give me a couple of examples.
Well, almost everything that happens in the book actually happened. So as you see her, for example, spend 4 years on this love affair with this man from Harvard who came up in the summertime and went back home in the winter, and who wrote her letters, many letters, and she wrote back, and then eventually he stopped writing and she discovered that he was engaged to someone else. It was a heartbreaking story. And Jean Olson wrote about it extensively in her book. And I essentially the outline of what happened. And I was able to use that real story and fill in the details as I imagined them. But there were many. I mean, when you read my novel, almost anything, any scene or anecdote is something that I've taken from a source. A nonfiction source.
There are, as you say, many details in this book. Some of them are really lovely. I especially just personally enjoyed reading about her cooking and her sewing. But there's a lot of other stuff as well about farming and fishing and sort of life in the early and mid-20th century in rural Maine. For you, as you were doing your research, first, how did you find out that information? And second, what stood out for you in particular?
It was really fun to do that work, some of which I had done to sort of look at how people lived without amenities in the early 20th century. I read some amazing books that are published in Maine, one of which is Old Maine Woman, and then there was a follow-up to that one. One's called We Took to the Woods, and it was about a woman and a family who just went off into this house and in sort of the present day, I think about 10 or 20 years ago, who lived the way Christina Olson lived. My friend John Vieg, who also is from Maine and Massachusetts, taught me a lot about fishing. And so the description, he fished with his grandfather as a child the way Alvaro fishes with his father. I reached out to many people to get those kinds of specific details right.
What stood out for you? What details did you think were especially interesting or beautiful or anything?
The way Christina lived in the world, given that she had this debilitating illness that got worse over time, she was incredibly determined, incredibly stubborn and obstinate in some ways. She wouldn't use a wheelchair. She almost until the end, she was cooking. She was even sewing. Her hands were gnarled and, you know, they got more and more fused. It was difficult to do anything, but she persevered. And she would drag herself around. She dragged herself to her friend Sadie's house. She would take herself down the field to visit the graves of her parents. She was determined to have mobility and dignity. And by the way, that is what Wyeth, I think, captured so beautifully. And furthermore, what he was attracted to in Christina, I think he saw this woman who just absolutely was not going to let herself be bowed or give in to self-doubt or pity, self-pity. It was an exciting relationship, I think, for both of them.
Christina Baker Klein is the author of 6 novels. She grew up in Bangor, and she lives now in New Jersey and Southwest Harbor in Maine. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And A Piece of the World is available now. You can read a longer version of this interview at mainepublic.org. And finally today, for the first time in decades, the length of the U.S. ski season is shrinking. And as climate change curtails winter's length and industry transformation is underway, one expert says most ski mountains in southern New England could be out of business in 25 years unless they diversify their offerings. But as Fred Bever reports, ski areas in the northern part of the region could benefit.
The region's weather has been pretty up and down this winter, including here at Sugarloaf in western Maine. But skier Ken Erickson says it could be worse. Some mountains in New England's southern tier have seen very poor conditions, and ski refugees are trekking north.
Well, this year they struggled. Well, you know how we know that? When it gets like that, they all come up here, and you see them on the lift.
Erickson, whose permanent home is in Gloucester, Mass., has been skiing here since the 70s. He says weather volatility is always an issue in the sport, but the threat of climate change frightens him.
I have big concerns about it, and I can see the season getting very short.
And the U.S. ski season is shortening up after a prolonged period when advances in snowmaking were helping to extend it. Daniel Scott directs the University of Waterloo's Interdisciplinary Center on Climate Change in Ontario. He says a continuing warming trend, as well as more extreme temperature swings, seem to have put the brakes on that snowmaking expansion.
We may have reached a sort of peak season era in the 2000s when we had a lot of snowmaking penetration, but now the climate has shifted just that much that in these last 5 years anyway, the average season length has tipped down for the first time in over 30 years.
Scott has a sobering analysis for the Northeast. Even under the most optimistic climate change models, all ski areas in southern New England will no longer be economically viable by 2040. That is, not if their revenue streams depend on reliable snowfall, particularly during the crucial Christmas to New Year's holiday week. Lower altitude resorts are most vulnerable. By Scott's account, low snow casualties will include Mohawk in Connecticut, Blue Hills outside of Boston, and some bigger places too, such as Jiminy Peak in Western Mass. And creeping into the northern tier, New Hampshire's Attitash is in the climate change crosshairs, as is Maine's Shawnee Peak, the starter hill for many Portland families.
And adding snowmaking capacity isn't necessarily the answer. We've seen that in the last couple of years where it's just too warm to even make it, or you do make it, but it melts so quickly, so you're throwing money out the door. So, yeah, they'll have to look at how to diversify their revenues, and not every ski area is able to do that.
But one door closes, another opens, right? Particularly for the altitude advantage survivors, such as most ski areas in Vermont, New Hampshire, and across northern Maine. That's why one-time New England ski magnate Les Otten, he lives near Maine's Sunday River, is building global warming into his $1.5 billion proposal to revive a defunct resort high up in New Hampshire's Dixfield Notch called the Balsams. It was never a ski resort, but an historic summertime destination that Otten says is well set up to be resilient against climate change, with a golf course and nearby lakes and rivers to bring in visitors outside of the ski season.
What we have to do is we have to create a winter that's sort of equal to the summer, and that's the Balsams opportunity.
The site is in a snowy sweet spot that could enjoy reliable skiing days through mid-century at least. Otten says he doesn't wish ill to others in the business, but he acknowledges that shorter and even terminal seasons at more southerly resorts could send skiers and investors his way.
You know, it's a hard industry to succeed in, and no one ever tried to take advantage or live off the disappointment of another. But it is very clear to me, looking outside the ski industry, that global warming is very real. The effects are real, it's there, and I think you have to plan for it.
Major ski conglomerates are responding, buying up geographically diverse mountains to hedge against local weather volatility, while offering winter and summer passes that now give visitors a cross-continental choice of mountains and seasons. Just last month, Vail Resorts announced a big move, purchasing Vermont's Stowe Mountain. And diversification is now the name of the game. Thus, the proliferation of mountain zip lines, canopy tours, gravity coasters, and golf courses. At Sugarloaf, its host town of Carrabassett Valley, and a nearby nonprofit called Maine Huts and Trails are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to add summer to the traditional wintertime destination, jointly developing a comprehensive mountain bike system. Town manager Dave Cota says it's paying off.
We'd go to the parking lots at the trailheads. They're filled up even in the summer, and we never saw that. A lot of it's second homeowners. I think they've got, you know, they've really got a reason to come back here. In fact, you know, what we're starting to hear is that people are actually buying property here because of that, because of the mountain bike trail development.
One telling sign, restaurants that once closed down when the forest leafed out are now staying open year-round. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Fred Bever.
And coverage of climate change on Maine Public Radio is made possible by a grant from the Dorry Taylor Foundation. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for March 10th, 2017. Thanks to our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty. Have a great weekend.